Chapter 1. Acquittals. Every writer on crime has at some time puzzled over the question of why certain cases capture the public imagination. Why were the Victorians so fascinated by the murder of Maria Martin in the Red Barn? And what did they find so interesting about the utterly commonplace murder of Mr. William Weir by Thurtle and Hunt? Why do we still find Jack the Ripper's crimes more interesting than many more recent cases of mass murder? Dean Call's sadistic killing of 30 boys near Houston in Texas, for example. The answer, surely, is that although most people are incapable of murder, they nevertheless derive a kind of morbid pleasure from identifying with the murderer and feeling glad that they're not in his shoes. The strange thing is that the reader does not identify with the victim, Maria Martin being shot or William Weir having his brains battered out and his throat cut, but with the killer. And when he has read about the execution of William Corder or James Thurtle, he experiences the same kind of pleasure you get when you wake up from a nightmare and find yourself in your own bed. This explains the otherwise baffling fact that the public seems to get as much pleasure from reading about famous acquittals as from cases that end on the gallows. The Green Bicycle case, the Pisan Hall mystery, the Gorse Hall murder turn up in anthologies of famous crimes with the same frequency as Crippen and Landrieu. Obviously, the reader enjoys the sensation of walking into the shadow of the gallows and then being allowed to escape. Certainly no man ever came closer to the hangman's rope than William Gardner, who stood trial for the murder of a servant girl called Rose Harsant in 1902. The reason was not his obvious guilt, but a certain sexual detail that scandalised the respectable British jury that tried him. June the 1st, 1902, was a bright, sunny morning after a night of storm. William Harsant, a carter, walked through the peaceful Suffolk village of Pisan Hall on his way to take clean linen to his daughter Rose. He walked through the wet garden of Providence House, where the girl was in service, and pushed open the back door. What he saw made him drop the linen. Rose Harsant lay half-naked at the foot of the stairs. Her throat was cut from ear to ear, and deep gashes covered her bare shoulders. She had been wearing a nightdress, but this had been partly torn from her and partly burnt away. A broken medicine bottle lay on the floor beside the body. The local policeman arrived, followed by the doctor. The policeman discovered that the broken medicine bottle had contained paraffin, which had apparently been used in an attempt to burn her. The girl's bed had not been slept in, but there were three letters in the room, one of which made an appointment to come and see her at midnight. The signature made it clear that the author was William Gardner, a young foreman carpenter who lived nearby. He had a wife and six children, and was known as a devout Methodist. Medical examination revealed that Rose Harsant had been dead at least 4 hours, and that she had been pregnant. No one had any doubt that the father of the unborn child was William Gardner, for in the previous year he and Rose had been the subject of scandal in Pisan Hall. Two youths had seen them walking towards an empty cottage known as the Doctor's Chapel, which stood alone in a field. The youths had hidden behind a hedge until the two had gone inside, and then crept closer. They were unable to see what was happening, but the sounds made it clear. There was a rustling of clothes, and then the girl gasped, "Oh, oh!" The silence that followed seemed to suggest a state of mutual satisfaction. Gardner was heard to ask her what she was thinking. She answered, "What you were reading last Sunday." He asked her what he had been reading, and she replied, "About what we were doing now." She then went on to quote the verses from Genesis chapter 38 about Onan's spilled seed on the ground. When the story was repeated in Pisan Hall, the villagers, who knew their Bible, had no doubt that Gardner and Rose Harsant had either been engaged in extremely intimate petting, or that the youths had overheard an act of coitus interruptus. Gardner was a Sunday school teacher. Rose Harsant was one of his choir girls. The scandal was so great that an inquiry had been conducted by the Reverend John Gray. Gardner had denied the story, saying that he had been in the chapel with the girl only to help her move a stiff door. Gardner had been told, "Let this be a warning to you for life," and had appeared to be suitably chastened. Yet although he promised to have nothing further to do with the girl, it was plain to people who observed them closely that they were still on intimate terms. The day after Rose Harsant's body was found, a superintendent of police called on Gardner and asked him if the handwriting on one of the letters was his. Gardner denied it. The policeman asked if the envelope in which a certain letter was contained was not identical with those used by Gardner's building firm. Again, he denied it. but the next day he was arrested and charged with Rose's murder. Certainly the case against him looked black. His clasp knife had been found to be stained with blood, although he claimed he had been cutting up rabbits. In 1902 there was no way of testing whether a blood stain was from a human being or from an animal. Paul Uhlenhut had discovered the basic principle in 1900, but it had never been used outside Germany. Various witnesses said they saw a large fire burning at the back of Gardner's house on the morning after the murder. The prosecution argued that this explained why no blood-stained clothing was found in the house. Gardner's wife testified that there had been a fire, but it was only the usual fire they lit on Sundays. But she did not explain why they needed a fire on a hot June morning. Gardner's defence was an alibi, supported by his wife. He said he had been at home all evening and had been in bed beside his wife all night. Gardner was lucky. In those days, the jury's verdict in a murder trial had to be unanimous, and one member of the jury stubbornly refused to be convinced of his guilt. The judge had to order a retrial, and once again the jury failed to agree. Gardner would have been tried a third time, but the authorities decided that he had been through enough and entered a noli prosequi, which meant no further prosecution would take place. It was equivalent to the Scottish verdict of not proven. Gardner and his wife moved to a London suburb where they opened a shop. Whether they prospered or not has never been recorded. Was Gardner guilty? We can never know. Certainly Gardner was not the only man who might have made Rose pregnant. Highly indecent verses were found in her room and proved to have been written by the youth next door, who was in love with her. She was no blushing wallflower, but a forthright country girl who had no objection to keeping obscene verses. She may well have had other lovers beside Gardner, a solution adopted by Brian Cooper in Genesis 38, his novel about the murder, which suggests that the dissenting juryman who saved Gardner's neck at the first trial knew the identity of the real murderer. Only one thing is clear. Gardner came close to the gallows, not because the evidence against him was particularly strong, but because the jury found it hard to forget that this Sunday school teacher had misbehaved himself on the floor of a disused cottage with one of his choir girls. In the case of the Green Bicycle mystery, a man escaped the gallows because no possible motive could be found for the murder of a pretty 21-year-old girl. Nowadays, juries would have no difficulty imagining a motive, but in the year 1919, the age of sex crime had not yet arrived, and the accused was given the full benefit of the doubt. It was on Saturday, July the 5th, 1919, that a farmer driving his cattle along a quiet country road in Leicestershire saw the body of a young girl lying in the road. Her bicycle lay nearby, and her head was surrounded by a pool of blood. The doctor, who was called, decided that she had met with some accident, but the local police constable was not satisfied. He returned to the spot the next morning, carefully searched the ground, and found a bullet that had been trodden into the road by a horse's hoof. The doctor now re-examined the girl and discovered what he should have noticed on the previous day, that she had a bullet hole below the left eye. She was identified as 21-year-old Bella Wright, a factory girl who lived in a cottage with her parents at Stoughton, a nearby village. Her father was a farm labourer. On the previous day, she had set out on her bicycle to post a letter, afterwards paying a visit to an uncle who lived in the village of Golby. She had cycled into Golby accompanied by a man on a green bicycle. Questioned by her uncle about the man's identity, she said she didn't know him. He had spoken to her on the road. During the hour she spent with her uncle, the man wandered around the village. Then she came out and they cycled off together. It was an hour later that her body was found. No clue to the man's identity was uncovered. The coroner's jury gave a verdict of murder by persons unknown, and there matters rested until February of the following year. A bargeman was leading his horse at a leisurely amble along the canal bank when the tow rope caught on something. The man heaved at it and pulled a green bicycle frame to the surface. It slipped back in immediately, but he recalled the Bella Wright case and reported the incident to the police. They dragged the canal and recovered the frame. It was a green BSA bicycle, and the number on the frame enabled the police to trace it to the shop that sold it in Derby. The shop had a record of the purchaser, a young man named Ronald Light. Light proved to be an ex-army officer who was now an assistant master at a Cheltenham school. He had been invalided out of the army, suffering from shell shock. He admitted to being the owner of the bicycle, and also to being the man who had been with Bella Wright shortly before her death. He agreed that he had disposed of the bicycle because he was afraid of being identified as the man on the green bicycle, He had also sold the clothes he was wearing at the time. He also threw into the canal a revolver holster and bullets. Light claimed that he had a slow puncture on the day he met Bella Wright, and that not long after they had left Golby together, it had become so bad that he decided he would have to walk home. Whereupon, he said, they had separated at a crossroads. He heard later that she had been shot. He also admitted to having owned a revolver at the time, but claimed that he had lost it during the last days of the war in France. Lack of motive certainly told in his favour, also perhaps the fact that he was an ex-army officer. The trial lasted only 3 days, and when the foreman of the jury announced the verdict as not guilty, there were cheers in court. Today, the prosecution would probably be more realistic and suggest something along the line that Light had picked up Bella with the hope of sexual intercourse, that he shot her during a struggle, then panicked and rode away, leaving her sexually unmolested. This view could have been supported by the evidence of two schoolgirls who said that when they were out riding, they were accosted by a man on a green bicycle who followed them for some distance. But there could be another explanation of Bella Wright's death. In a nearby field, a dead crow was found lying in a pool of blood. Did some farmhand, out looking for rabbits, take a shot at the crow, kill it, and also kill Bella Wright, who was in the line of fire? A gunsmith who gave evidence agreed that the bullet could have been fired from a rifle. Both the Gardner and the Light cases continue to fascinate criminologists because the killer's identity remains a question mark. In the equally baffling Gorse Hall mystery, the killer was not only seen by several people, but actually overpowered and locked up, and still the case remains unsolved. George Henry Storrs was a wealthy mill owner who lived in a mansion near Duckinfield in Yorkshire. On September the 10th, 1909, Storrs was drinking tea with his wife and a friend when someone from outside the window called, "Hold up your hands or I'll shoot!" Then a shot was fired, breaking the window, and a gun was jammed in. The blinds were drawn, but Storrs pulled them aside and saw the gun barrel. He was about to rush outside and tackle the burglar, but his wife begged him not to, and apparently the man went away. The police investigated the matter, placed a guard on the hall for a few weeks, and then allowed the case to drop. But 6 weeks later, on November the 1st, the cook ran into the sitting room saying, "There's a man in the kitchen!" Storrs rushed out and saw a small, slightly built man with a blonde moustache who had a revolver. They struggled. Mrs. Storrs was about to hit the man with a shillelagh when he shouted, "I won't shoot!" They snatched his revolver and locked him in the scullery. Storrs then went into the kitchen while his niece, a Miss Linley, left the house and ran for help. Suddenly there was a smashing of glass. The man had broken the scullery window and climbed out. He came back into the kitchen and this time attacked Storrs with a knife. When Mrs. Storrs and the servants reached the scene, Storrs was dying of several stab wounds, and the man had fled. Someone bent over the wounded man and asked him if he knew the identity of his attacker. Storrs shook his head and groaned, "No!" The mystery was baffling, but the police had a few leads. If the same man had broken the window in September and twice attacked Storrs on the night of the murder, then he was a man with a grudge. After the September incident, Storrs had said that he knew of no one with a grudge against him, certainly not one of his own workers. There was, however, a poor branch of the family named Howard. 2 weeks after the murder, Storrs' cousin, Cornelius Howard, was arrested and charged with the crime. He had a criminal record, and both Miss Linley and Mrs. Storrs identified him as the attacker. Howard had no moustache in court, but a barber gave evidence that he had shaved it off the day after the murder. The evidence against Howard was certainly overwhelming. Only one question puzzled the prosecution. There was no apparent motive, and of course Storrs knew his cousin and should have recognised him. Howard's alibi was that he had been playing dominoes with the landlord of the Ring of Bells in Huddersfield. The landlord corroborated this, but he was an alcoholic whose memory was poor, and it was strongly suggested by the prosecution that the evening on which Howard had played dominoes was the one before the murder. Howard was certainly a bad character who had been arrested many times for burglary. He was not uneducated, and Miss Linley had described the murderer as being a superior type of workman. Is it possible that, whoever he was one of those working-class socialists, followers of William Morris and Bernard Shaw, who decided to strike a direct blow at the exploiting class by killing the wealthy mill owner? We shall never know. Howard was acquitted, so was another man who was put on trial for the murder at a later date, and the mystery of the killer, who was seen by several people, remains unsolved. But perhaps the most remarkable of all cases of acquittal is one that took place in Bridgeport, Connecticut, in 1924. The fact that it has been turned into a film and a play testifies to its dramatic quality. On a bitterly cold February evening, the Reverend Hubert Dahmer, the popular priest of St. Joseph's Church, Bridgeport, was shot down in front of a crowd of people on the corner of Main Street. The killer simply walked off. The police were baffled, for the kindly old priest had no enemies, and they could think of no motive for the killing. Then, 2 weeks later, the police of the neighbouring town of Newark made an arrest. The accused was a 28-year-old alcoholic named Harold Israel. Under long, non-stop police questioning, he broke down and confessed. He had been broke, starving and exhausted on that evening of February the 4th, he said. He had been unable to find a job for months. As he walked down the street, uncontrollable hatred seethed up in him. He pulled out his revolver and shot the first man he saw, the old priest, and then ran away. A waitress in a nearby coffee bar came forward to say that she had seen Israel passing the window shortly before the murder and had waved. The state attorney, a brilliant young man named Homer Cummings, seemed to have an open and shut case. But he was far from happy. It just didn't make sense. Why should Israel have been starving when he had a revolver worth $5 in any pawn shop? If he shot the first person he met, then why had the priest been shot in the back of the head, not the face? Cummings went to interview Israel, and his suspicions were confirmed. Under long questioning, the alcoholic's shaky nerve had broken, and he confessed merely to be left alone. He insisted to Cummings that he was in a cinema at the time of the murder. This left the evidence of the waitress. Cummings went to the hash house with his deputies at 8 o'clock one evening and asked the waitress where she was standing when she saw Israel. She showed him. Cummings looked out of the window and could see nothing through the steam and the bright lights of the street refracted in the glass. He sent some of his men to walk up and down outside. At a few feet, they were unrecognisable. Cummings himself went outside and told the waitress to wave at him as he went past. She waved twice to the wrong man, but failed to recognise Cummings. When she admitted that she had applied for the reward, Cummings knew her evidence was worthless. In court, he summarised what he had learned and asked for the case to be dropped. Israel walked out of court, a free man, sobbing. The shock had the effect of sobering him. He married and became a prosperous timber merchant. The young attorney later became Roosevelt's attorney general. But the murder of Father Dahmer remains unsolved to this day. The moral of these famous cases of acquittal is a strange one. The murderer who stands most chance of escape is not the careful planner, who broods on alibis and concealment, but the incompetent, who kills without forethought. An odd conclusion, equally unsatisfying to the policeman, the criminologist, and the reader of crime stories.